Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Now, I love the cooker, not only because it's a great gadget, but also because it's modern and energy efficient, which is topical for today's podcast. I realize actually that I've become someone who thinks about the environment. My motivations are because it creates a better life for me. Obviously, I'm conscious of it being good for the planet, but also I just like things to be the way they should be. So I use refillable soap because I don't want to use the, you know, the one-use plastic out of the cartons you take into the shower for whatever. I have an electric car because I'm told that's good, but it's very efficient and it's a lovely ride. I did buy a diesel car once though, because I was told that was good and it turned out it was ridiculous. I do mainly cycle everywhere though, because I just kind of like being out on the road cycling, and it's, it always feels like it's good for my health to do some more exercise. So I'm doing it. Maybe that's a selfish thing, but I think you live a better life that way. People will always find ways of telling me that choices are still damaging the environment in another way. And there's always that, like possibly the battery in the electric car is bad, but I don't know. So I'm just going with what I assume is a good idea. But I also assume because I breathe carbon dioxide, that's not good for the environment. Just being alive means I'm adding to the problem. Do you know what? I have no desire to stop breathing just at this moment in time. Go green by turning blue. There you go. That's the catchphrase. If we all want to stop breathing, maybe we put less carbon dioxide into the air. I don't recommend that, by the way. Anyway, by making the environmentally friendly choice makes my life feel better. That's how I feel at the moment. And the cooker tap uses a vacuum to keep the water hot. I have literally no idea how that works. I skipped that science lesson at school, but it has a vacuum. It keeps the water hot, means it doesn't have to keep reheating it, so it's good for the environment. I love my cooker tap. If you can afford one, then I recommend them, as they're great. Go to cooker.co.uk and you can see all the models, how much they cost and everything. It's all there. On today's show, I'm curious about where we're getting housing wrong and what we can do instead. You're going to love this. You're going to think differently about our towns and cities. Years ago, I did a series of short documentaries on the future of for Channel 4. One of them was on the future of housing. I met today's guest and he changed my thinking on houses forever. I tell you what, let's meet him because he's great. And I was going to go into some of the things that he says, but you know, if we just meet him, you can listen to what he has to say and make up your mind. It's a modern way of thinking about it though. His company is called WikiHouse. He's called Alistair Parvin. And I think you're going to be fascinated by this. Alistair, hello, how are you?
Hello, I'm very well. How are you doing?
Good. Really well. Are you busy at the moment?
Always. That's a sad answer, but true, honest.
Right, okay. I don't know where really how to start this. I suppose we've got to work out where you think possibly we're going wrong. If we start, let's start on a big headline, then we'll go back to how you got to that place, as in, because I know you want us to change the way we view architecture, architects, our society and buildings, don't you?
Sort of, yeah. I definitely believe we need to, I think probably a lot of people believe, I don't think it's just me. I believe we need to quite fundamentally redesign the way that we make our homes and our neighbourhoods. Because I don't think the way that we do it today really matches any of the things that we say we want from, you know, the places that we're creating, you know, in both in terms of the way they look, but also in terms of affordability, in terms of the environment and carbon, in terms of health. You know, that's the amazing thing about talking about housing. To talk about housing is really talk about everything, right? So we talk about things like the housing crisis, but, you know, there's an increasing realization that it's really the everything crisis, right? This sits at the heart of almost everything. And if you look at the events over the last few years, it's really interesting, isn't it, how, you know, we seem to be entering this kind of cascade of one crisis after another. And yet each time, you know, so COVID came along and suddenly exposed, you know, we were all forced to spend all our times in our homes. And it really exposed the fact that actually a load of people don't even have outdoor space in their homes, or, you know, and so, and so what these crises do is they expose the fact that, you know, we're not doing a good enough job. And that, and so it feels like there's a kind of growing awareness to say, actually, can we redesign how we do that?
Yeah. Do you know what's interesting is I've always thought, actually, it was after meeting you the last time I started thinking about housing and a lot, which I'd never thought about before, because we just know the way it's done and that's the way. And that's it. And I started thinking that it's a really weird thing that we have people without homes, homeless, you know, because we wouldn't let anyone struggle without food, would we? As a society, especially Britain, you know, we've got the NHS, which looks after our health. You know, we would always make sure someone got some food, hopefully, and maybe a bit of money. But another important thing to survival, if you look at Ray Mears or Bear Grylls, the first thing they say is, when you arrive on an island, make sure you find somewhere to live immediately.
Yeah, get it's some the shelter. Most basic. Yeah, it's the most basic thing. And of course, housing it's not just about the house, is it? It's also really about the location as well. So even your other needs, which is to have friends and community and family nearby around you, that's all part of this as well. And that, yeah, it's like it's one of the reasons why it's so hard to talk about you know, the kind of housing crisis. But it's like, yeah, it's very hard to know where to start, because it is weird. Like, we're sort of used to talking about the housing crisis as if it's a normal thing. But if you think about it, how weird is it that we're in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and yet we live in, we can't afford housing, right? And the housing that we build and we do live in isn't really up to scratch in a lot of cases. A huge number of people live in substandard housing, huge numbers of people in energy poverty and so forth, right? You could go on forever down that list. And this is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. In fact, the wealth, it seems almost the wealthier country you are, the worst housing crisis that you have. And that's a sign, that's a flag, isn't it, right? That this is not just a problem of, oh, we don't know how to do it, or we don't have enough money. It means there's something kind of weirdly broken about our housing market and about our housing systems.
Okay, well, I know you've got your ideas of where that is, that it's been broken. Let's start to how you got there. So you qualified as an architect, and then you had that light bulb moment, didn't you, when you didn't have any work?
Yeah, sort of. So I trained as in architecture, and I kind of pretty quickly realized that although I think of myself as a designer, I'm not really a designer of things. I'm really interested in the design of the systems through which things get made, in particular buildings. So the construction systems, the design systems, the planning systems, the procurement systems, those kind of invisible layer of operating systems of how we do things. And a lot of that sort of came through that journey for me, which was, you know, I went to architecture school, and, you know, I worked out in architecture and things like that. And what became really clear to me was, yes, this kind of pressing question of why is it that a wealthy country like the UK has a housing crisis, but also that an awful lot of what was wrong, or what people were seeing was wrong with the current system, or, you know, a lot of people, what they call sort of bad design or bad housing, it wasn't because, you know, we don't know how to do it. It wasn't even necessarily because it's somebody's fault, right? Or someone in particular is greedy. It's because it was this idea that actually it's the way that we do things, and that wasn't necessarily a thing that you're allowed to be a designer of. There isn't a label for that. So along the way, I think that's what I kind of more became, and I think that was definitely kind of brought into stark relief by, for example, the fact that I graduated into this, you know, into this financial crisis in 2008, 2009, and that kind of, yeah, was sort of made it really obvious to say, okay, we actually need to design things differently. And whose job is that? And it's really no one's job. So we said, well, let's just follow the white rabbit. And I think a lot of my career as a designer has just been sort of following the problem, following the white rabbit further and further down the hole and going, right, ooh, what if we did that differently? Or what if we could redesign that? And actually, loads of people out there have loads of great ideas about how we could do things differently. And so that's led us to where I am today. We have a company which is called Open Systems Lab, which is a non-profit R&D lab, which is a slightly weird thing to be. We're like an R&D lab, but we work for everybody.
What's basically R&D mean?
So research and development. So right. Yeah, in the same way that, instead of doing research and development on, say, a new product or a new medicine or whatever it is, what we're trying to do is come up with new ways of organizing ourselves in some of these sort of invisible systems, in terms of how do we build our homes, how do we design our neighborhoods, how do we do this thing called planning, and things like that.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about your projects then and how they work, Ricky House and printing off houses, before we get into my new show of where we're going on and how we can change it.
Yeah, so yeah, we're working on a few different projects that sort of at different places in the system. Probably the most well-known is Wiki House. So Wiki House is effectively, if you sort of close your eyes and imagine Lego for real houses, you're not far off. You've sort of got the rough idea. So it's a building system, but instead of using kind of bricks and blocks, which are incredibly slow and using a huge amount of carbon and quite difficult to use, the idea was, could we make a manufactured building system that made of kind of block components that you can assemble really, really quickly? Even if you don't have construction skill. So I don't want to say flat pack, because they're very robust, but you get the idea that there's kind of these components that, and they're all made of wood, of timber, and that's obviously important because it means we can make carbon negative houses. So we can maybe come back to that in terms of the carbon footprint of our homes. But that ability to make, the mission is to make it as easy as possible, particularly for self-builders, communities, and for small businesses and housing associations, to build zero carbon homes really, really easily. And we just want to make it so easy that we take it off the table. And the other thing that's different about Wiki House is that there's lots of cool stuff going on now, bringing sort of different modes of manufacturing innovation to the way we make houses. Generally, they involve really big factories that cost millions of pounds. And we thought, oh, hold on a minute, there's something really interesting here, which is, what if you could use these CNC machines and set up small factories almost in a garage for a few thousand pounds and have a network of those sort of Dunkirk boats, but for factories, all spread across the UK. And collectively, that might be a kind of distributed factory, if you like. So that's Wiki House, and that's probably, we love that project, and it's particularly lately, it's really accelerating in terms of our progress on that. So that's really exciting. But we're also, that work led us into other areas of exploration. So I'm also playing with some kind of software. So how can we make it easier to design homes? So we're developing a web-based tool where you're kind of designing a house, and you can imagine it knows all the rules. So you can just push and pull it, and it's automatically counting every screw, calculating the cost, calculating the carbon as you're designing. So all those things that make design really difficult and opaque, we're trying to make that simpler. And then we're also working on another project called PlanX, which is basically the same idea, but for making the planning process much, much less opaque. So anyone who's ever come into contact with our planning system will know that it's like, it's as clear as mud in the dark, right? It's an absolute nightmare. So trying to use the power of the World Wide Web to kind of make it much, much easier and much more transparent. And that's something that we're working with an increasing number of local planning authorities.
Okay, a load of questions off the bat. Wood is carbon negative. How does that work?
It depends. So obviously, when we think about the carbon emissions that our houses emit, we generally think of all the energy that we're using, right? So if you have a gas boiler, obviously that's for heating your house, for lighting your house, or whatever it is. Even if you're using electricity, depending where that electricity comes from. So that's what we call the operational carbon. So that's the amount you emit just by using the home every year. And that's huge, by the way. That's something like 28% of all carbon emissions. is from the using the house. But another huge amount of where that carbon comes from is what's called embodied or upfront carbon. So just by building a house, the moment you, before you turn the key and walk in the front door, that house has emitted many, many tons of carbon just in the production, the kind of the extraction of all those materials, the firing of the bricks, et cetera, et cetera. So your typical house has emitted somewhere between 30 and 50 tons of carbon just before you've even used it. Now, that's kind of crazy because we all know that's the exact opposite direction. So, and all that, those, that embodied carbon, again, is 11% of all emissions in the world right there. Now, the cool thing is that if you use sustainably forested wood instead, of course, the clever thing about trees is that they're taking carbon out of the atmosphere and they're storing it in wood. So it's a way to actually, what you can actually do is make a building, instead of having a building that's emitting carbon, you can make buildings essentially carbon sinks, as it's called, that's sort of a warehouse for storing up carbon. Now, it depends. We have to be careful about the end of that, the life of that building. Obviously, it has to be kind of used in the right way, but hopefully you can reuse those components for a very long time or just use the house for a long time. So it means that not only could we talk about making zero carbon homes, but we can talk realistically about essentially making carbon negative homes. So using building to tackle the climate crisis.
Is wood a good material to use though? I mean, is it, will that keep your heat in as well as modern?
We've been using wood to make houses for hundreds and hundreds of years. Wood's a great material to use. In terms of, obviously you have to insulate it as well. Right.
It's not very good with fires, is it? I was in Stavanger. I've gone there quite a few times, and because the whole town was made of wood at one stage, they had to have towers.
Yeah.
With firemen in them years ago, fire watchers, I think they're called. Mm-hmm. They just used to stand there looking at the town because if there's a fire, the whole town could go up. So they had to register.
We don't fancy 1666 again. Thank you very much.
Exactly. So
would it? No, I mean. Well, obviously wood is more flammable than other things, but then if you look at some of the big fire disasters, they don't involve wood at all that we've had in recent years, right? So the good news is that there's lots of really good building codes for building with wood that make sure that we can build with it in a safe way. And in fact, also, it's not like building with wood is really controversial, because if you live in a kind of, you know, a house that's made of brick and blocks, you go up into the attic, have a look around, see what that house is made of, wood. Mm-hmm. So your roof and your floors are all made of wood anyway, right? So we use wood all the time. All the internal walls in your house are probably made of wood. So there's rules just like everything else. So wood is not, it's one of those kind of myths that wood is an exception. We shouldn't use wood because of fire. Right. The main important thing about using wood is that we have to make sure that it's being sustainably forested. Right, and and that has impacts for the planet as well. So we have to make sure that it's coming from forests where they're replacing every tree that they cut down is being replaced by many more trees. Otherwise, that whole equation doesn't work.
What's the lifespan of a house, do you think? What should it be?
This is a good question, right? Because there's the official lifespan that they're built to, and there's the realistic, if you like, economic or social lifespan of a house. And I think the realistic economic or social lifespan of a house in the UK today, in our current sort of land system, is hundreds of years bordering, you know. So the lifespan of commercial buildings is incredibly low, right? And you'll have seen that in your own town. There'll be commercial buildings that were built even only 30 years ago that they're knocking down. Yeah. But homes...
They've just knocked down Blockbusters in my...
Right, just because their business model went out. Exactly. So, but homes tend, for a whole bunch of other reasons, homes stick around. So in theory, the materials that you'll build a home, so if you take Wikihouse, for example, we use engineered wood, plywood panels, which are very, very strong. And the guaranteed lifespan of those is 60 years, right? But in practice, and of course, that's fine because your mortgage company is like, yeah, fine. But in practice, you've got to design that house to last much longer than that. And there's no reason why it shouldn't. Again, if you go and find the oldest houses in your local area, they'll probably be late medieval or medieval, and they'll probably be made of wood. So as long as you keep it dry, it could last ages and ages and ages. The other thing, which I think is, worth thinking about, is the way that buildings age is they don't stand still, they change. So you can think of a house as having lots of layers. So the furniture changes often quite often. You change the kitchen or the bathroom lots of times during the building's life, the structure not so much. And, you know, we sometimes joke a house is a bit like Trigger's broom in Only Fools and Horses, right? He says, oh, I've had this broom 20 years. I've replaced the head 7 times and the handle 5 times, right? And a house is a bit like that, you know, in practice. So that's another big part of how we need to be building our homes differently. We need to be building them to last, building them to evolve, but also build them so you can replace them, you can extend them, you can switch out parts during the life of the building, and that's all right. That's what old traditional buildings could do.
Yeah, though I often look at my house, and it's a Victorian house, and it really winds me up because it creaks everywhere. Because of, you know, it's old and it annoys me how much it creaks. I reckon if you shot one of those guns at my house to see where the stuff was leaking out, it would be just like red everywhere. I put a new roof on it, and when the builder came and said the roof's kind of rotten, let's do the whole thing. So I've you know, it's Trigger's broom here. I've got a new roof on it. I've put new floors all downstairs and everything. But what I'd really like to do is knock down the bloody external walls, because they're the bits where it's all leaking out of. And so I went in to look at it, and they said, well, we can pad it out inside and then put some modern materials. I'm like, why can't I just knock it down and start again on my little bit? And that's where we get into planning and everything, isn't it?
Right. Planning and also finance. And that's a really interesting thing, is the way that so the planning system will have views on you knocking down the whole house again. And I think we totally should be doing this more the way. I mean, this is probably a controversial view, but I would love it if we could be fully recycling all the old materials from houses, but actually replacing them. You know, don't get me wrong, I love those old Victorian houses, and we do need to get one of the big challenges we need to do in the next few years, I'm say decades, but it's more urgent than that, is retrofitting and really upspecking those. And I'm down, you know, let's keep, they're beautiful, some of those things. But if in a lot of houses, they're not beautiful necessarily, and there is a strong case, especially in suburban areas, for knocking down houses and building, so you could knock down two semi-detached houses and build three bigger townhouses in the same space, right? So we can increase housing. So there is an argument for knocking them down. The big barrier isn't just planning, and that's a big part of it, right? Is how do we as a people give ourselves consent to do that? Our old model isn't really allowing us to do that very well. And so I'm really interested in ideas like these things called street votes that could potentially help with that. But it's also your mortgage company. So your mortgage, if you're still paying your mortgage company will get very iffy about that, despite the fact that most of the value of your property is actually in the land, not in the house itself. So where you do see people do that, it's often they're in the fortunate position of having paid off their mortgage.
Yeah, but I realise that I've got a bit of a mental block. So I walked into my house, and I'm just about to replace the windows, actually, and the front door, because I've thought to myself that the builder's always gone, oh, you've got original windows. Yeah, they're original, and they're single glazed, right? And I've got an original front door. Excuse my language.
They are beautiful.
But it's on the piss, and it's got all stained glass in it, and everyone goes, oh, it's amazing, it's the original one. But it just, you know, you can actually feel the draft come in there every single night. And yet I'm the same as everybody else. We get so preoccupied by the history of stuff, you know. And, you know, I drive a modern electric car. I don't drive a 100-year-old car. Yeah, I'm living in a 100-year-old house, way over that. And I'm trying to keep hold of all the original features. You know, I remember they came to do plaster. One of my ceilings was falling in. And so they came to do it, and they went, oh, Tim, I need to speak to you before you replace this. The plasterboard's actually original horse hair. Do you want us to try and rescue it? And I'm like, no, I don't want horse hair. I want something modern. You know, it's like, but this is where we've got to.
We're funny creatures, aren't we, with this, though? I always say that, like, we are like, I remember seeing a chap, he was a very wealthy chap, and he was wearing a tweed jacket and using the latest iPhone. And he lived in an old house and had the latest Audi. And I said, isn't this funny? Yeah. Like, there's some things in our lives, and bathrooms are funny because they're on the edge, because some people like a really Victorian bathroom, but actually most of us are more like, no, we like a modern bathroom in an old house. We're funny like this. And personally, I like, there's a lot of dimensions to this. So there is the stuff about planning and conservation. There's the stuff about beauty. There's part of it which is, part of it is a sadness, which is the truth is we all know that in most cases, because of our really broken development models, if you were to knock down these old houses, the truth is they probably would be replaced with something ugly. And that's a shame, right? Wouldn't it be cool? Like these beautiful, at least these big, beautiful Victorian and Georgian houses have these lovely high ceilings. Why don't we build houses with high ceilings anymore? Well, there's a bunch of reasons why we don't do that. And we should fix those so that actually we can build new homes with confidence that they're not just going to be energy better performing in terms of energy, but also beautiful, right?
And so that why don't we do high ceilings? Because of energy,
it's more boring than that. It's because most of our homes, this is the big open secret at the heart of how we make homes today in the UK, is that we're, for most of the homes we build, we're dependent on a very small group of very large companies called house builders, but you know, they're better known as developers or land traders, right? And they're not building homes as things to live, they're building them as things to sell. Right. So if you kind of look at their business model, it sounds a bit harsh, but it's essentially equivalent to ticket touts at a concert. Right. Their job is to buy up land before it has planning permission, get planning permission on it. Its value shoots up and then they build the smallest homes that they can and then sell them into the home. Now, and again, I want to be really careful here. This is not a kind of all bad, greedy people. This is not about them being bad, greedy people. They're just good people, just like you and I, but they're in a really bad business model, right? When it comes to these things, we need to be much better at not blaming the players, but blaming the game, right? We tend to always blame the players and we don't look hard enough at the game. Whereas actually, if you look at that business model, they have a very, very natural incentive. Once they've got that thing and they can sell the house, what the house is worth is basically like, right, if it's got two bedrooms, the mortgage market will say it's worth this, that will go for that. So within that, they then have every incentive to build essentially the kind of cheapest facsimile of what house used to look like that they can get away with. And that means making the ceilings lower, making the windows smaller. Now, the weird thing is that if if you were doing that, like the executives who run those companies, and again, I'm not being personal here, but if you look at where they live, they don't live in those houses. They live in a lovely old farmhouse or something in a village, or a big Georgian townhouse or something, or a big grand designs thing that they built for themselves. So for me, the heart of how we build is that what I find is that across, you know, it's weird how we're supposed to all, you know, hate each other in our political tribes, but I find there's an amazing amount of agreement across the political spectrum about the sorts of houses and places that we want to build, as in big, generous, lots of daylight, good energy performance, beautiful, and we all kind of broadly agree on that. The thing is, the only people with an incentive to really do that, to build those houses like that, are the people who are going to live in them for the next 20 years and pay the heating bills, for example. Mm. And yet, that's the one group of people who have almost no power in the commissioning process of new homes. And that's kind of really weird. And it's because of our dependence on this speculative development model. So I think one of the big, you know, root challenges for what we can do is to say, let's change the way we build. You know, wouldn't it be cool if you, for example, there's bits where this has been done in the Netherlands, where people could buy a plot of land, it's pre-serviced, it's got very outlined planning permission on it already. You can buy a plot of land, the pipes are there sticking out of the ground, and then it's, you know, off you go. You build, you can commission it. Now, if you want to do the whole self-build, you know, Kevin MacLeod, you know, pregnant holes in the roof while the rain's pouring in, then you can do that, right? But equally, that would also create this whole burgeoning market of companies that say, no, actually, we can make it much more convenient than that. We can make it buying a house as convenient as buying a car. And you can have it customized to you, but because you're in charge, you're going to say, yeah, I want higher ceilings, please. I want more daylight windows. I want to invest in the more insulation in the walls, because that's going to pay for itself in cheaper heating bills.
Yeah, it's funny because you keep, or you know, don't keep, you've said a couple of times, they go off and live in their lovely old houses. And I always think about that we've got this sort of, I don't know, sort of block, colour, what do you call it, blinkered view on houses, that the older they are, the nicer they are. Now, when I go onto your website, which I was looking at, Wiki House, by the way, go on the website, it's fantastic. It's real, you know, you get an education. It's great to see it because it changes the way you view things. But the houses on there, to me, are so attractive. That's what I want. And I was talking to my parents about this the other day, and they said, but if you don't have planning permission to look at that new house built in our road, and then someone's built a very modern house with flat roof and lots of glass. And I went, I love that house. And they went, oh, it's not in keeping. And I went, so what? Is it really offending you? There's a house which actually looks beautiful in your road. And they were like, but it doesn't fit with the road. And I'm like, but it's beautiful. It's a love. Someone's, they've got a real amazing designer in to design this thing.
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. And I don't know how they've got away with that actually to do it, but they have. And so who decides what's beautiful, lovely,
that's
old?
That's a great question.
And what's lovely and modern? Because I love the idea, like you say, buying a car. You know, I like to look at an E-Type Jag. I don't want to drive a bloody E-Type Jag. Literally no, you know, like an old E-Type Jag, one of those things. I want to get into a car, and I actually like the electric cars now because they don't have that dragging feeling. I like to press a button and go and not worry about it, you know, and I want it to just work, and I want the seats to heat up, like, you know, like all those things we're used to now. I don't want to sit there trying to. And so why can't I have that in a house, which I, you know, it comes to the end of 40
imagine,
years.
Imagine if if the design of houses had evolved in the same way that design of our phones have, right? We actually have a list which we keep on somewhere on the Wikihouse website. It's just a list of features that all houses should have if we were really focused on like that kind of experience. So you talked about things like heated seats. On that list, we've got even the little silly things like the ability to turn on the shower without being under the stream of water at the time.
Yeah.
Right? Drop boxes are standard, so you don't get those annoying red slips from the thing saying, sorry, you're out and we couldn't deliver your parcel. You know what I mean? Like, there's a whole list of things that if homes were actually designed for people and bought by people, they would do all this stuff.
Yeah. Do you know what's interesting? I literally don't want any tech in my house. I just want it to be modern and work. I want everything to fit properly and close properly.
Yeah, that's
My house is, again, excuse my language, it's on the piss because it's so old. So everything, when you come and try and do it, like when they tried to fit blinds in my house, they're like, oh my God, your windows are all over the place. Of course, because they're 100 years old. Of course they're all over.
Yeah, this is one of the secret powers of WikiHouse, because it's the components are manufactured on this machine. It was go together and it's dead straight. And it really weirds people out. Like we had someone, they got in, you don't need to actually do plaster skim if you don't want to, because it's so straight, but you can just put drywall on. But they got a plasterer in, and I was chatting to the plasterer after, and he said, it's weird. It's this, my whole career, I've been doing this career for, you know, decades, I've never had a straight house before. The whole thing just went, like, it took 2 seconds to do because it was so straight. So yeah, and it's absolutely a thing. As you say, it's the basics, right? It's not about fancy buttons and you know, weird futuristic stuff. It's just a window that's straight and doesn't leak.
Yeah.
I heard a quote recently which I loved, which is apparently Angela Merkel was once asked, as the Chancellor of Germany, what for her sums up Germany as a country, and she thought about it and said, airtight windows. No other country does such nice airtight windows.
Wow. But it makes a difference, doesn't it, if you have something like that. How would you...
No, but going back, I want to go back to, very quickly, if I may, to your thing about beauty. And I think there's, my view is a little bit, let a thousand flowers bloom. My personal thing is also, you know, so that the kind of houses we're really interested in is, actually, we look a lot at traditional houses, and we think that there's what we call patterns. So types, design formats, the things that are good about traditional houses that actually can be dusted off and brought into modern houses. So say high ceilings, those lovely big doorways, and, you know, not having a car blocked between you and your, you know, and the road, like, so your bonnet isn't right up against your front door, like tuck the car to the side or something, you know. So there's lots of design patterns and stuff that we can learn, and we're really, really interested in that. And to some extent, when it comes to aesthetics, I'm fairly, like, you know, let people, you know, it's a question, let people decide. But you can think of it as a kind of what decision gets taken at what level. If you start from the individual to the neighborhood to, say, the county to the country. And I always think a lot of problems in planning can essentially be drilled down to things being made, decisions being made at the wrong level. So, you know, no individual, like, community or inversions to say, oh, I don't care about climate change. It's like, well, sorry, we're all in climate change. We all have to deal with it. But equally, people quite reasonably be upset if someone starts telling them what door handles they have to have, right? Because it's like, well, it's my house, my door handles. So how do we negotiate that process? The thing that we have to remember is that the planning process is meant to be the process by which we negotiate with ourselves, if you see what I mean. We give ourselves collective permission. And unfortunately, that sort of got broken because we're in this sort of trapped in this circle is because we are dependent or we think we're dependent on these speculative developers, we therefore are used to the idea that they're the only people that build, and therefore the only way that we interact with our planning system is usually to object to something, right? But imagine if we flip this the other way around and we say, no, we didn't take that as assumed. What if more places were actually made by the people who are going to live there, either individually or as a whole group of communities? So you see these beautiful places like older women's co-housing in Barnet. Google it, ouch. It's a wonderful little development that a group of older women got together and built themselves essentially a little kind of village. And it's urban, right?
What's
it's in older women's co-housing in Barnet. There's lots of these sorts of great kind of co-housing and interesting developments across the UK where they, you know, get lucky because they managed to get some land to do it. So it's not always individual. It can also be at the scale of a group. And often what they can do there is say, yeah, actually, like, if we imagined more development would be like that, then actually we can move to a planning process where instead of it always just resisting against stuff, actually communities can say, oh, what kind of development would I actually be okay with? And what we see again and again, and then there's, you know, companies like YouGov and, you know, these polling companies do these polls about this, support for new development completely naturally rockets up when people can see that it's going to be really good quality, green, much more attractive, and much more affordable development. Surprise, surprise. So this idea that, oh, people in the UK are against new development, the NIMBY thing, I think it's a bit of a kind of self-perpetuating story. It's not really true.
Interesting.
Because if we did development differently, I think support for development would go up a lot.
Yeah, my friend who does developments, he was saying, he just talks about NIMBYs all the time, won't stop going on about them, how they're ruining his life because there's no housing and people are just stopping it happening all the time. What's really interesting, though, about this planning permission and about what we should keep, I think the best example, actually someone told me once, and I don't know how true this is, maybe, that in London we started knocking down so many houses, or in Britain we did, we started knocking down so many houses and building ugly things that there was a panic, there was a knee-jerk reaction to where people said, let's never do that again. Let's make sure we keep everything which is old.
Yeah.
And it's climaxed, in my opinion, with the Hammersmith Bridge, which about 3 years ago, for anyone who doesn't know, in London there's this bridge in Hammersmith. It's this beautiful green old
Victorian thing, isn't it?
Such a lovely bridge. It's made of wood and it's falling down. So basically they had to stop everyone using it. They've strengthened enough to let pedestrians on it now, but no traffic. But it means the people in Barnes and the people in Hammersmith are trapped from each other where they used to be able to cross the bridge. Now, rather than do what the sensible thing to do would go, it was a beautiful bridge, it was 100 years old, it doesn't work anymore. Right, let's knock it down, let's build something new, maybe it's something which can harness the energy, maybe let's like find something which actually works really well, and, you know, let's think of a modern way of doing it and put a new bridge in there. They're trying to fix this bloody bridge. It's 3 years down the line. They're talking about millions to try and do it. There's all these different, everyone's arguing because no one wants to pay for it. It's ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous. And now they've got this boat thing. Actually, they wouldn't let any boats go in the Thames under it for ages because it was too dangerous. Yeah. And that is where I think the whole, you know, that's where we've got to, where we think a 100-year-old bridge needs to be safe. Just take a bit of it, stick it in a museum and be the rest.
And
let people look at it in a field.
There's part of me that thinks maybe you're right and actually... maybe it's a symptom of a nervous society, as Cedric Price would have said, is an architect who's in the 60s. Maybe it's a symptom of a nervous society that we're always clinging on to the old instead of looking forward to the new. And actually, as I say, maybe if we had better approaches to being more to how the new worked, we'd be more positive about it. If we were more confident that new development would be good, we'd be more for it. Equally, there's part of me that thinks, well, maybe it's just human nature, you know, and maybe that's okay. Like, so whilst my approach to this is, like, I think it will always exist, and I think we do need to find ways to have better quality arguments, if you like, about what bits of our towns are part of that kind of heritage that's actually beautiful to keep and that's good, and which bits aren't. But there's, before we get locked in that sort of binary argument, let's lift up the players and look at the board underneath. There's something going on here, which is also, we say, oh, there's not enough money to do that. Well, there is enough money, right? But it's all going into inflating land and property. It's amazing to me that in various bits of government right now, you have in the same building, one person at one end of the building going, where are we going to find the money to fight climate change or to preserve this historic kind of thing in our area? And at the other end of the building, there's someone else going, oh, what can we do about this rampant land price inflation? Oh, right. Because which is a problem of too much money, if you like, right? That's essentially right. What house price inflation is. And house prices is crazy, isn't it? That in a massive crisis over the last year, house prices went up by something like 30% or something. Really, really, don't quote me on the number off the top of my head, but incredible that we're ratcheted into this crazy thing where land prices are getting more and more unaffordable. Now, to be clear, we talk about house prices. It's not the house that's getting unaffordable, right? The house is still the same house. It's the land effectively underneath it, right? And the land and the permission to use it. That's the actual thing that's changing value. And it's changing value because basically people can borrow more to pay for it. So the weird thing is that the value of those land assets has been skyrocketing into billions and billions and billions to the point where we are today, where land and property is 80% of the UK's wealth. And land is, depending how you calculate it, land is definitely more than 50%. So at all the gold, all the businesses, they're like a sliver of wealth on the top of that, right? So I've heard it said recently, this sort of Britain is really just a housing economy with a small economy. Sorry, is really a housing market with a small economy attached, right, today. Okay. So the notion that there isn't enough money is mad, right? The money is here, but it's being locked into those land values where they're no use to anyone really. And of course, then it's being captured by land value speculators and things like that. So really, I'd be more saying, well, how can we change that system so that instead of having an old Victorian house with leaky old windows, etc., sitting on a piece of land that's worth £700,000, can't we take a bit of the value that's in that imaginary value in the land underneath the house and spend it on that extra however much it costs to replace the lovely old sash windows with things that are double glazed but just happen to still look like lovely handmade wooden windows, right? The money is here to do it, and that would create loads of jobs as well. So I think we sometimes, like, yeah, we could easily be trapped into a binary there, and all along the real issue is saying, well, wait a minute, the money is here. Why are we using the money to kind of inflate this imaginary value of land and debt instead of spending it on the things that we all agree we want?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to ask you a big question here, a complicated question. Is what does architecture actually mean? And what would you do with something like Manchester or London or one of the big cities? Because, I mean, my kids could never afford to live in London, I don't think. And I don't know how people are affording houses. I was lucky I got a housing ladder 20 something years ago, so I managed to do it. But the prices are ludicrous now. How do we change it to make affordable housing in a city? What is architecture, and what would you do to help the cities?
Well, there's two questions there. So one is the what is architecture, which I'm not sure I have. I've been studying it for years now, and I've still got no answer for you. I was just this joke that the most useless thing about architecture is that no one knows what it is or what it's for, but the most exciting thing about architecture is that no one knows what it is or what it's for. You know, most buildings have nothing to do with architects, but, you know, I can, broadly speaking, say, yeah, architecture is kind of the thing that's shaping our buildings. And as I said, I think a lot of times we would think people would say to us, "Oh, you left architecture. You're no longer an architect." I think we are working in architecture because we're still working in the realm of how do you design the systems that shape our buildings.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's got to leak into the whole city, hasn't it? Really,
exactly.
Architecture and into society.
Exactly. And so the big insight for me, and I wrote a thing when I was a student that was called "Form Follows Finance," right? Because you know there's this famous thing about form follows function. And I said, well, form follows finance. In other words, if you design the underlying systems well, if you design the business models and the land system right, in a way, good architecture takes care of itself. Whereas if you design them badly, no matter how good an architect you are, there's not a lot you can do to make those houses any less crap, frankly, or any more affordable. So that's why we're really interested in the stuff that we're really interested in, is saying, well, can we redesign those things? Now, to go back to your question of what do we do, now actually, Manchester's actually, doing pretty okay. It's the land system isn't as mental as it is in London, but let's take even harder, places that are struggling even more, right? So you kind of on the other side, go on the other side to kind of the Middlesbrough and places and like that. And today we have this myth of this thing of build homes to bring prices down. And don't get me wrong, I want to build homes, but it won't bring prices down for a whole bunch of reasons to do with the developer's business model and other factors going on. It's not how it will work. So for me, if I really wanted to turn around some of those places, what's been called the leveling up agenda thing, I would focus on the place, the location itself, right? Because that's another factor that's been going in here, is that on one level, young people can't afford to go to London, but then that's increasingly where you need to go if you want to make it big in advertising or whatever sector it is. So our economy is becoming more and more centralized around London. We need to break that cycle. So take this fascinating fact, right, which is imagine there's two houses that look exactly the same and they could only be a few hundred yards apart, maybe even on the same street. But one is inside the catchment area of an Ofsted Excellence school and one isn't. Well, the one that is going to be, I think it's last estimate, somewhere between £40,000 and £80,000 more expensive.
Wow.
Right.
Okay.
And we tell ourselves we don't have school fees, but we do have school fees. They're in the house prices.
Right.
It's the most British thing. All, as Winston Churchill said, all goes back to land, right? So yeah. So actually what creates the location value is the schools, the roads, and so forth. So the kind of the green infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. So personally, I think it'd be really interesting to sort of make loads of amazing local transport connection infrastructure in the north, cycle lanes, and loads of amazing schools. Like spend a colossal amount of money on making incredible schools, and don't build any houses. Just make plots of land with planning permission, right?
Brilliant.
And people will move out of London to go and build themselves a nice house.
The school thing is, you've absolutely hit it there, because the whole conversation with my friends for years has been about schools and who's in a good catchment area and where am I going to live. And I've always thought to myself, okay, so if this school is doing so well, it's in a great Oxford, then now the government should redistribute loads of money to the school next door, which doesn't have, it's actually happened up the road to me now. And they've got the secondary school, so it's really good standard. And now everyone's not moving out. They want to stay there, or they don't want to send their kids off to different schools. Yeah. They want their kids to go because they've done it. And it's just, it's such a simple fix, is make sure all the schools, make sure they're all good. They should all be Ofsted excellent. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, no, that's it. I mean, and again, in 1909, Winston Churchill, right, much lesser known speech by Winston Churchill, is he gave this speech called The Mother of All Monopolies.
Yeah.
And it's worth Googling it. It's a really fascinating speech. And it's got this fantastic bit in it where he says, essentially, roads are made, streets are made, street lights turn night into day, water is brought thousands of miles off the hills, right? These are the things that make a place habitable.
Right.
And all the while, the land monopolist sits still and earns the money, right? They take the money,
Yeah.
Without, so that's our opportunity, is to say, well, how can we change the way that we develop? So instead of that money being extracted and taken out of the system, it's reinvested into building the community infrastructure, which is what creates location value in the first place. And again, going back to the kind of the NIMBY thing, we see this again and again, which is if more of that, I mean, it's pitiful sometimes when you read the headlines where, because of our negotiated planning system, we managed to have this situation where a developer, and again, this is not because they're evil, it's their job. They have a fiduciary duty to their shareholders to negotiate down their contributions. And you get this thing. So, you know, I think I saw recently in Manchester some massive towers, and there's a tiny number of affordable homes. And the only bit of community infrastructure they were paying for was a school, which of course is going to increase the value of their assets anyway, right? Okay. So, but if we take if we take that value and say, no, let's change the way we develop so that actually we recapture that land value, which is created by all of us, right? And that's what Winston Churchill was saying, is that, and Adam Smith said exactly the same thing. If we go deep down the rabbit warren of economics textbooks that have been overlooked somewhat. You know, land value is really created by all of us, right? And through our governments, through investment in railways and roads and schools and so forth, and reservoirs bringing water 1,000 miles off the hills. So if we can get more of that money being reinvested into that, it's really cool. Because and so one of the kind of I guess you could call it a slogan, but a kind of line that we're using more and more is this idea of we need to move away from a country that sees land as an asset, a financial asset, towards a country that sees land as a platform, right? It is a platform for our success. So instead of it being this thing which is at the root of so many of our environmental and social and economic failures, it actually becomes a platform for our economic prosperity and hopefully an affordable platform for then re-injecting that money back into community infrastructure, back into allowing people to live near their friends and relatives so that actually they can care for each other, taking some of the burden off the care crisis, and so on and so on and so forth. So we can take us downward spiral and begin to reverse it round. And whilst some of that can and should be done at the level of Westminster, an awful lot of it can be done locally. Like, we can start showing the way on that wherever we are.
I knew you'd give me some gold dust today, and I'm going to be a pub bore again, down the pub going to everyone. Infrastructure. It's fantastic. You talk about communities there, and this really intrigues me because a friend of mine lives in one of those lovely old buildings around Chelsea sort of area, across, you know, on the squares. And she lives in a flat there, and the flat backs onto the garden. They've got a community garden there. Oh, actually, I've got two friends out that way. And they get keys to their garden
key gardens.
But in her case, the actual house is all back onto it, and that's the only way you can get into it. And I said, what's it like having a community garden? She goes, it's actually really lovely because we all come out and everyone says hello to each other. We've all sort of got our own little plot, which is the bit right by our little bit. But the kids all play. We've all voted that there's no dogs allowed in this bit because we don't have dog poo everywhere because there's too many kids to go. And I was like, hold on, there's a community here. Now, step forward to an interview I did with Tim Marshall where he was talking. He wrote a book about us putting more and more barriers and fences up in the world than there's ever been. Since the Second World War, more people have sort of put barriers and fences up between countries. And in the beginning of his book, he starts by saying, we all started getting gardens and putting fences up and going, this is my land. And it started with agriculture and people going, hold it, I'm going to farm it. But it's gone to residential now where we go, this bit's my garden. If I look out my window here, we've all got
fences.
But
a lot of that, to remember, go back to what I said before, remember that a lot of the new homes being built are not being shaped by the preferences even of the people who live there, but by the business model of the developers who built it, right? Yeah. They were the ones who create these sorts of cookie cutter homes in a kind of sea of tarmac. With these high fence, you know, atomized garden. And then it was like, oh God, I've got to look after my own garden. It's actually really hard work. I'd much rather have a bit of private garden and then that opens onto a shared bit because it turns out you only need two or three, you know, old retired people in your community and they'll look after the shared garden for you, right? it's weird how we've lost a lot of these old patterns. You know, throughout most of human history, we've lived in a kind of a certain scale of organizing, you know, villages. And then in the 20th century, because of these business models, we hammered those out. and we forgot that it takes a village to raise a child, right? We put ourselves into this sort of, at the scale of the atomized nuclear household, which is a kind of myth, really, because, and we saw that, you know, how beautifully did we see that during COVID, right?
Yeah.
When all locked down, people came out and they looked out for each other and they started bringing food. And that was actually, people suddenly really appreciated the kind of company. And they really, sometimes you hadn't spoken to your neighbor for a long time, you know? Yeah. And it's like, well, what if we built infrastructure? What if we built our neighborhoods for that? Mm. And all, what I find really also odd about this is, for completely right, I mean, sensible reasons, I think, we've normalized the idea that you should own your own home, right? And ownership is a whole separate conversation we won't go into. It's actually another fourth project that our Open Systems Lab is working on. Is we're trying to explore designing a new form of ownership, which is a weird thing to design. But you know, we've normalized the idea that, you know, your own home, it's good to own your own home. But we haven't normalized the idea that it's good for a neighborhood to own itself as well. Isn't that weird, right?
Yeah.
And so we have all of these fights with sort of these kind of landlords who are just, you know, doing nothing to maintain these areas. And sometimes I saw an amazing example in Hackney a while ago where some people who lived on an estate had started gardening. As one of those weird, you know, in those 60s estates, you kind of get these weird bits of leftover grass.
Yeah.
And they just started gardening on it, made a community food garden. It looked great. Wow. And the council said, oh, no, you've got to, it wasn't even a private developer, right? It was even the council at that point. It was like, oh no, you can't do that. That's not allowed. Right. So the idea of stewardship is really, really cool. And the idea that you should, as a group, be able to make certain decisions about certain shared things, but then just your own decisions about your own private space as well. It's like you can think of it as concentric rings, and it's like we weirdly removed a whole bunch of middle layers of the concentric rings, and yeah, that's really strange.
It, on Wiki House, one of the things is one of your sort of printout houses, if that's what they're called, is it takes two people.
Don't call them that.
Don't call them that. All right. The Wiki House, it takes two men to, or two men and women. You're trying to make it.
Yeah, we try to make it agnostic.
Yeah, so that you can put it up in a matter of a week or something. And it's like, can you imagine as a community building a load of houses together?
Yeah.
That would create a community, wouldn't it?
Honestly, it's one of the most beautiful. I could write a whole book. I won't bore you with it, but it's one of the coolest things in the world, because we think really hard about this stuff, but actually when you do it on the ground, you don't need to write any theory. It's just it's coded into ourselves, right? In fact, there is a word. We don't have a word for it in English. The closest we have is barn raising, but in other languages have, so in Norwegian, I think it's called dugnad, and I think Kenyan it's called harambe. So it's basically kind of community work. When people come together, they make a thing together, and then usually they have a big meal together, and then that's it. And it's always happened. It's like, it's just a thing that's sort of in our DNA as humans to do this, unless it's forced out of us. And it's really, really cool. So we've seen this happen with Wiki House builds, where suddenly your neighbor, instead of being the one who's objecting, is turning up with cakes, you know, and offering you cake during the build. And we always say there's this irony of, particularly we see this with Wiki House, is that you get to the end and you've built this thing, and the irony is you could knock down the house at the end of it because you've built the real thing, which is you've now got a group of people who've realized that they could build a zero carbon house anytime they choose to.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the really cool bit of it. And it's really interesting to watch those kind of dynamics play out that have been around for thousands of years.
In the pandemic, it happened to a lot of people. I know it happened to a lot of people in London. I think it happened all over the country as well, in places where neighborhoods were doing, because everyone suddenly got WhatsApp groups. Yeah. Everyone was joining a WhatsApp group for their local road or their neighborhood. Ours is still going with people saying, did anyone know what the police were doing here last night? Or has anyone got a drill? And it's just, it's created this beautiful community in our road where if you want anything desperately, has anyone got any flour or something, you know, that people pop round and they give it to
them. And I think the cool thing is building the community infrastructure for that, because often it only takes one little thing, you know, be it an old phone box that's been turned into a library or whatever it is, that to catalyze that, Right. Often, ironically, it's a developer threatening to develop nearby that gets the community talking to each other. So, you know, WikiHouse has been used on lots of community cafes. There's a cool initiative as well called Library of Things, which is worth checking out, which is like, is what it says on the tin. So it's they're popping up now all over the place, where it says a library where you can borrow a tool, but from a library, which is cool. But weirdly, that's very much where we started with WikiHouse was, and it's, you know, our hearts are still really there. We love self-build, we love community build, but of course, it's not only about that. So there's a kind of that spirit should also bleed into our economy. So we said, all right, let's make a building system that's as easy as possible to build with, so that even a non-professional, you know, group of friends can come together and do this right. But actually, then the industry turned around and said, well, actually, by the way, we've got a massive skills shortage because all the qualified brickies are all retiring. Mm. You know, one response was, oh, right, we've got to train up new brickies. Our response was, guys, bricks are really carbon intensive. They're beautiful, but really carbon intensive. So, actually, suddenly that it opens up the new possibilities, the idea of, well, actually, you're not necessarily dependent on a big construction company. Maybe you can just find a local manufacturer and a small thing. And this has happened with a lot of WikiHouse projects where they've done a project and they've actually set up a new business. So at the end of the project, you not only have houses, but also small businesses. So, and that's cool, right? Again, like it, so, yeah. So it's saying, actually, wouldn't, I like the idea of a Britain full of small local businesses doing really cool world-class stuff.
Alistair, we're coming to the end of the hour. I like to keep these an hour. I've got a couple more questions, though, so quickly get, how much traction are you getting with your ideas? Are the people in power listening to what you have to say? Are they open to it? Are the other architects?
I could answer that many ways, because on one level, sometimes it feels futile, but on another level, I just feel like history will come in this direction because the old models are running out of ideas.
Yeah.
Right? You can't. There's only so long we can go on pretending that, you know, trying to square the circle. You know, government's always saying, oh, we want to make housing more affordable, but then rolling out policies that inflate the price, you know. So that is running out of road. So increasingly, these things do have more and more traction, not least because the old system is just getting more and more ridiculous and more broken, so that more and more people are looking for sensible, workable alternatives. The other nice thing about this is it's quite cross-party. So it's not that, like, none of this is the preserve of the left or the right, right? We find an amazing degree of unity across almost every corner of the political spectrum. And that's encouraging, I think. That said, it is still one of the most challenging things to even contemplate, because especially when it comes to home ownership and the land, you know, the land system, it is the oldest thing. It's been there since the feudal system, right? It is the oldest, toughest thing. Even trying to, as we started, you know, we started this conversation talking about how hard it is to talk about. Well, one of the reasons it's hard to talk about it is because we don't even have the words, and we don't even have the words for the same reason that fish don't have words for water, right? Because we're swimming in it, right? Yeah. And we all have our own personal vested interest in one sense or another in this system, and it's failing all of us. Even the super wealthy are being failed by this system, but equally it's failing some of us much, much worse, right? Self-evidently, in terms of homeless people, people living in poverty, people stuck, you know, with a mold on their walls and the landlord's not doing anything. Very, very different from the privileged position that you and I enjoy, where, you know, we actually have a mortgage and own our home or whatever. So you know, we're all in different positions in this broken system, and of course people are understandably they're nervous of change. So that that's where we start, in a way. Our brief is, how can we find a way to build a new way of doing this that isn't kind of scary, that isn't about getting the pitchforks out and storming Westminster or whatever, you know? It's actually about creating a new system and then inviting everybody along. So that we can find a way to transition from this obviously crap system that we currently have to something better.
Alistair,
and I think we will get there sooner or later.
thank you so much for joining me today. Any listeners want to hang on, I'm going to ask Alistair one more question, but I say goodbye because it's the end of the hour, and then I'm going to ask him another question if that makes any sense. So all of you have had your hour, you can tune out now, but go to WikiHouse and have a look at that, because I just think it's such a beautiful idea, and I really like it. Where else should they go, Alistair, if they want to find stuff out? Is that the best place to head?
That's the main thing for now. Yeah. There's also opensystemslab.io, but that gets a bit more niche, so it's talking about some of our other projects as well.
Okay, yeah. Now one more question for you. My bonus question is, what do you think of the Barbican? Because it's brutalism, isn't it? Is that what it's called? But every time I go to the Barbican, I get excited, because I thought whoever designed that, whenever it was designed, that concept, I know people think it's ugly and horrible. I think that whole concept of the Barbican is so beautiful. The idea that they had the restaurants there, the housing, they all kind of looked at each other, it flowed. And people think it's ugly. I think it feels so exciting. And I imagine when that first went up, everyone was like, wow, we're living in the future here.
Yeah, exactly. It's arrived.
Yeah, it's arrived. Yeah. This is fantastic. And then people can't stand it. What's your views on the Barbican?
So this is a perfect example of my personal view on this, is that I think it's really easy to get drawn into the style wars, right? To say, oh, I like traditional and I like modern or whatever it is. And I think the Barbican's a great example of style is just the surface, because fundamentally what matters is what the thing is like as a place, how well made it is. And Barbican, I mean, Barbican's ridiculous, right? Like, you go around, the corner has areas built out for the plugs, framing around the plug sockets, and it's just amazing. And it does have lots of fun little features, like this sort of, I was talking about the shower thing, but they had those macerators in the drains. It's got lots of really clever little user-friendly features. It's like, style doesn't matter. Let's hope that, Britain in a few decades' time has a whole myriad, it always will and it always has, or have a whole myriad of architectural styles. That's not what matters. What matters is that the style shouldn't matter. Right, is that whatever style it's built in, it should have shops, right? And that shouldn't just be able to work in East London. It should be able to work everywhere, right? It should be able to have kind of a cultural venue. Now, sure, it might not be a kind of world leading gallery and exhibition centre, which the Barbican is. It might just be a community centre, but that's cool too, right? So I think that's my takeaway from that, is that don't get drawn into the style wars. Look at the underlying patterns of what makes a place work.
But listen, if we get away from the style, what they created there is beautiful, don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Good. Alistair, thank you so much. That was fantastic. Thoroughly enjoyed that conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I learned a lot and you've inspired me. Thank you.
Thanks. Cheers.
In today's world, planning ahead isn't always top of mind, but not having life insurance can leave families facing difficult financial uncertainty during already emotional times. In many cases, loved ones are left managing expenses, debts, or long-term obligations without a clear plan in place. Life insurance is one way to help provide financial security and support when it's needed most. That's where Ethos comes in. Ethos makes getting life insurance fast and easy, and it's 100% online. You can get a quote within seconds, apply in minutes, and even get same-day coverage. There's no medical exam. You just answer a few simple health questions online, and coverage options are flexible with up to $3 million available and some policies starting at around $30 a month. Ethos has also earned strong customer feedback with a 4.9 out of 5-star rating on Trustpilot based on more than 5,500 reviews as of August 2026. Help protect your family with life insurance through Ethos. Get your instant quote today at ethos.com. That's ethos.com. Application times and rates may vary.